Welcome to the Entertainment Engine.
Welcome to Season 2 of the Entertainment Engine podcast. I'm Pete Moore.
And I'm Bex Gregory. This podcast was created by our company, Seamless Entertainment. We're providing in-depth advice and information for creatives pursuing a career in the entertainment industry.
It's a great passion of ours, and we're looking forward to sharing our knowledge with you all.
Each week, we'll be bringing our listeners some great entertainment facts and news, mixed in with special guest interviews from seasoned professionals who share their insight and experience of the business.
You can listen and subscribe to the podcast on all streaming platforms so you never miss an episode. And what a bonus, it's totally free.
And now it's time to introduce our next special guest on the show this week. We chat with Hollywood producer and director John Cry. When he first came to Los Angeles in 1995, he had no idea what development was. Already a successful stage actor and theatre producer from Boston, but always had a fascination with film. His first job at Summit Entertainment was a script reader. His work at Summit brought him to the attention of two investors who hired him to help form a new independent production company, New Market Films. John took on the job of creative director. The first film developed was Memento, and it was the second feature from the director Christopher Nolan, and nobody in the business wanted to distribute it. Fortunately though, New Market Films stood behind the film and built a distribution arm to support it. So began New Market's run of indie classics, including Donnie Darko, starring Jake Gyllenhaal, Drew Barrymore, and the film Monster, starring Charlize Theron, The Prestige, starring Christian Bale, Hugh Jackman, and Scarlett Johansson, The Mexican, with Brad Pitt and Julia Roberts. Cry's latest project, Chance, is a 2020 American drama film directed by John Cry and starring Matthew Modine, who has starred in many film and TV projects, including Full Metal Jacket, Weeds, and Stranger Things. It's based on the true story of Chance Smith, and it is also Cry's feature directorial debut. Here's the chat we had with John earlier this week.
Well, thank you for joining us today on the Entertainment Engine, John. First of all, tell us a little bit about where you grew up and your early life.
I'm originally from Memphis, Tennessee, here in the U.S., and born in 1970, and I think that the entertainment industry was probably the farthest thing away from Memphis, Tennessee in 1970, at least as far as I knew. I didn't have any family that was in the industry or anything like that, but my older brother was interested in theater and interested in film, and I think got me interested in from a very early age. Pardon, I've got a cat that's trying to get in my boot.
You're being attacked.
Cat's like, why are you in the booth? And you've got the door closed. During the shutdown, they've gotten very unused to me being anywhere that they can't find me. You know, growing up in Memphis, going into film, you know, was kind of, maybe a dream. But I think, you know, I'm also 50, and I think pretty much everybody from my generation would probably tell you the same thing, that around 7 or 8 years old, we saw Star Wars and kind of blew our minds, and that's kind of where it started for me.
Yeah, I'm not ashamed to say, John, but I'm in the bracket of you, so I'm just over 50. So my first movie, very clearly, was 1978 at Edinburgh Cinema Complex in Scotland with my auntie, my first time into Scotland, and I saw Star Wars, and I was absolutely blown to bits with it. It was just phenomenal.
And I think it was the... here in the States, I'm not sure if it played there, but there was a making of Star Wars television documentary was about an hour, but it showed some behind the scenes stuff, you know, showed, you know, Kenny Baker getting into R2-D2 or, you know, showed Ben Burtt recording sound effects. And it was just the first time that I had ever seen anyone talk about making a movie before. I think, you know, I was 8 years old, and prior to that, I don't know that I actually thought about movies being made, much less how or who. And seeing that documentary just completely changed that for me. My little kid head exploded, and I kind of became all about film, you know, at that point, and learned everything that I could. But, you know, as just a lover of film in what I considered, you know, a very small town kind of, you know, backwater, the farthest thing from Los Angeles.
Yeah, because it's interesting when you mention about your older brother, because your first job in independent film in 1980, I believe, was working a homemade clapboard for your big brother. So that
yes,
must have been
indeed.
Real fun. Yeah, tell us a bit
more. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was 10 and really thought I was doing something, man. My brother was the one that I think had the aspirations, you know, for film before me. And he started shooting, you know, Super 8 movies in the backyard, that kind of thing, and roped me into doing whatever needed to be done. And, you know, from that point on, I think I started thinking about how could I do this? You know, how can I make movies? How could I be involved in this? And, you know, in school, that got me involved in theater, and went to college for theater, and did not go to school for film because theater just seemed imminently more doable to me. Mm-hmm. Film still seemed really far away. But when I was in school in Boston, I started a theater company in Boston, and stuck around Boston for several years after college doing theater, until finally I thought, you know, I'm either going to go to Los Angeles and try this, or I'm not. Mm-hmm. And so we loaded up the theater company and moved to Los Angeles.
Wow!
Brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, did you feel as well at a young age when you was working with your brother as well, John, that you had good support from your family as well? Was you encouraged to sort of go in the sort of creative way?
You know, yes and no. I think that my mother's always been very supportive, and just, you know, felt like if that's, you know, following your dream, if that's what you want to do, you should really, you know, you should really try to do that. Mm-hmm. She has been very, very supportive. I think my dad kind of kind of looked askance at the whole thing, and like, well, maybe eventually you'll get over that. you know, I've now, you know, been professionally doing this for 25 years, and I think I still kind of have to explain to him what it is that I do sometimes. But still, you know, I didn't have to. I know that there are a lot of people who, you know, really have to go through that sort of, you know, Billy Elliot style rejection of, you know, there's just no way you're going to go into entertainment. And I didn't really have to deal with that.
No.
It's always the way, though, isn't it, sometimes as well, John, because you talk to people and they say, what is entertainment? And you think, well, don't you watch TV and films and go to the theater? And, you know, how do you think all that gets made? And it always makes me laugh when people say, but how does it get done? It's just crazy sometimes.
A lot of hard work.
I'm always surprised when people will say things like, oh, I saw this terrible movie. How did that get made? And I think, you know, you should really ask yourself how any film gets made. You know, it's remarkable when a good film gets made, because there's so many things that could go wrong. It really is. I think of it really when you watch a film, the thing that I think a lot of people lose sight of, it's a little bit like when you watch the Olympics and you see every single gymnast is just amazing, and because they're all the top of their game, and it makes you think, oh, you know, well, you could get up there and flip around on those bars. No, you couldn't. No, you sure couldn't.
No.
You know, every film that people see, you know, the average person sees, it was a miracle in getting made, but it was made by a bunch of people who work hard and do this kind of work every day, and made this, you know, this little wonder that that maybe you liked it, maybe you didn't like it, but it took a lot of hard work and no magic to get it done.
Yeah.
And and sometimes, you know, because there's no magic, sometimes those movies don't turn out so good. Sometimes you have bad ones. So what?
Well, yeah. You know, sometimes you go for a bad meal and you didn't enjoy it. And sometimes, you know.
Yeah.
And you, sometimes you're lucky enough for someone to pay the bill. You know, it just happens.
Yeah. Yes, there are a lot of ways to enjoy a meal. Yeah.
And also, as well, John, looking at your career, I understand you had no idea what development was. And when you was first hired to do it, your boss didn't know either. I mean, how did that work out? And what was that experience like? That,
oh boy, yeah. this is a real,
that's mad.
Yeah.
A real story of falling into it. Yeah. Like I said, I had a theater company, in Boston. This was in 1995. My partner and I in the theater company, we decided that we were going to either go to New York or go to Los Angeles. And we're both from the South. We both decided we didn't want to spend another snowy winter. And so we came to Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And we thought we could continue the theater company just the same way, you know, just get started up. We actually did find a theater. We started booking. We had a weekly show that ran for about a year, and then we started to realize that Los Angeles is just not the same kind of theater town that Boston is. You know, we couldn't keep filling the theater every week the way we were in Boston. And I started looking for work in film. My partner Bill, we had a vaudeville team called Daily Cry. He's Bill Daly and I'm John Cry. And we had this sort of this vaudeville duo routine, sort of a, I guess the British equivalent would be a sort of a Markham and Wise that we were doing. And it was a show that was a lot of fun on stage, but it just wasn't going to translate to film or television. And Bill ended up going into writing for television, and he's written for a lot of really great series. He wrote for Mike and Molly and 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter, and is a bunch of US shows. I went into film. Film just was more interesting to me. And I started working at a foreign sales company called Summit Entertainment. They belong to Lionsgate now. They're a division of Lionsgate. At the time, they were an independent sales company. They would acquire rights to foreign films and distribute them in the US, and they would take rights to U.S. films and sell them overseas. And I was working there. I just got, you know, an assistant job. And basically, because Summit didn't like to spend a lot of money on coverage, which is essentially like a book report for the screenplays that come in. You know, they have someone, usually a lower level person, an analyst, read the screenplay and write a synopsis and, you know, give their opinions on the thing. You usually have to do that because there's so many screenplays coming in to any given company that, you know, no one executive can read them all. So you get these, you know, reports generated. I was one of the only people writing them in the company. And at the time, the company was backed by these two private bankers. And they started noticing, you know, my name was on all the reports, on all the coverage. And so they asked me, you know, if I would ever like to migrate over and, you know, start a creative department for them. They were investors in Summit, but they were starting their own company. And would I like to come over and, you know, form a creative department and take over the development? And I had no idea what they meant by development. I'm a theater guy, you know. I was writing vaudeville. I was doing juggling bits. And, as you know, they offered me a job doing development. And I just said, sure. all right. And I was making short films at the time. I was trying to teach myself about film. I was making short films at the time with a film student who had gone to the same school as me, a guy named Aaron Ryder. And we were making shorts. And so when I said, hey, I got offered this job to, you know, be the head of development at this new company that they're forming, they like my opinions of the material coming in. They want me to develop screenplays for them. How about you come over and be the head of production? Because, you know, you're producing the shorts I'm doing. Okay. And so he came over and we're reading scripts and giving advice on where these guys should put their money. And before I knew it, I was doing it, because apparently that's what development is. Working with writers and giving them notes and trying to, you know, make it better. Essentially, what I found myself doing, just to drop another Star Wars reference, was I was like the protocol droid of film, that I was an artist who was hired essentially to talk to artists. These are two bankers, both of them English, who had come to LA, and neither one of them necessarily knew how to talk to creative people. So they hired me to kind of translate for them. And if there was a, you know, a film that they wanted to pick up, or a screenplay they were interested in, then I was the one that needed to go talk to these, you know, crazy artist people, and then come back and tell them, you know, what I'd discovered in a way that they could understand.
Yeah. Wow. It sounds like you're really thrown into the deep end, really. And you sort of big learning curve.
It was. I was fortunately young enough and dumb enough to not realize that, you know, that's not what you do. Yeah, so I just went right ahead and did it.
It's brilliant, though. I mean, you must have learned so much in that role.
I felt like I learned a lot about film just by reading a lot of bad screenplays. Realizing those things in a screenplay that made me want to stop reading. Because I was probably, as a script analyst, I was reading sometimes upwards of, you know, 10 scripts a week, and writing analysis on them. So it was a bit of a crash course.
Yeah, that's quite, that's quite tough just in its own right, John, to be able to do that. And you must have got, I don't want to use the word bored, but it must have been quite tough to just, you must have got really stale reading sort of 10 scripts a week.
When you have a young child and this is your job, you find motivation to read those scripts, you know. My ex and I had just had our first so it was definitely a time where it's like, well, I'm gonna read these scripts. I'm getting paid $50 for each one of these, so I'm just gonna knock them out as fast as I can. I'm not proud to say was probably not the best work ethic at the time, but it certainly did teach me a great deal in a short period of time about screenplay.
And always as well, John, it always, again, makes me laugh, where if you go to college or you go to school and you learn certain things and you come into the real world and nothing really prepares you until you're actually in the baptism of fire. And
it absolutely sounds
like it's a bit like sink or swim, and you had two choices and luckily you kept swimming, which is positive.
Well, you know, that's the what you just said about what you learn in school is absolutely the case. Even though I did not go to film school, a lot of my friends did. And I've talked to them about various parts of my job, whether it is, you know, dealing with foreign sales and getting foreign sales estimates, or the long-term, you know, development strategy of a screenplay. These are things that I don't know that anyone necessarily teaches it. There are, I know that like the USC program has got, there are producing programs that go into some detail on the work of being a producer. But as far as being an executive goes, I don't know that there are courses. A lot of the guys that over the last 20 years that were working in the agencies, like Creative Artists Agency, or ICM, UTA, a lot of them, it seemed, were like Harvard Business School grads. And business school would probably give you another angle on it too, but still, they're not going to cover what people really need to know about this business when you're getting in to do the day-to-day of it.
No, No. I completely agree with that. And I think I've always been a supporter as well, John. If you've got a mix of education and someone on the street level and you combine them two, then you've actually got quite a powerful person. Mm-hmm. And I remember some of my first days in the record industry where, you know, some of the people I work with, the executives and going to chairman level, where sometimes they weren't particularly interested in someone having a degree. They wanted someone to come in that could, you know, learn from the ground up and actually learn the business properly rather than thinking they can walk into a job and get, you know, a big salary from day one. I wasn't too keen on that area, to be honest.
Mm. Well, you know, I agree. I would much rather know that someone has got the work ethic and is going to put the work in. And particularly in the film industry, you know, it's probably true of any speculative business where there's a lot of money to be made, but people are kind of speculating on how to get in and get it, you know, be part of that business. You've got a lot of people who are just dishonest, who are making more of their credits or making more of their ability to get things done. And there's a lot of faking it until you make it. And because of that, I think it's really important that anybody that you work with is someone who is willing to put work in and, you know, willing to sweat a little, because you need proof that they can actually do what they're saying they can do.
Yeah,
it's true.
No, absolutely. And absolutely. And that really leads sort of onto as well, John, with the when you obviously had worked with investors and you're working at Summit, and then you had your first meeting with Christopher Nolan and obviously the Project Memento.
Yeah.
What were the difficulties there? Were there just too many to mention, or distribution, or how did that sort of work out?
You know, it's really funny. I just saw an article, a friend of mine on Facebook who lives in the UK just shared with me an article from The Guardian that was about the 20th anniversary of Memento, and which feels like it should be longer ago than that, but might have been an old article, but anyway, what was interesting was the article, this is in The Guardian, and I assume there's some standard of journalism, but even they made the mistake of not doing the research and reporting that, you know, the great difficulty of Memento was, you know, it was this little small film that fell to a small distributor that did its best with Memento. And that is not at all the truth of that story. The truth is, you know, when I came in to form this development department at Newmarket, at that point, they had invested in about 40 films, but it was gap financing. They were coming in at the very end and, you know, putting in a little chunk mm-hmm. of money. I pointed them toward, like, the first film that I was involved in with them in that capacity was Velvet Goldmine. That was one that I, you know, had really, really pushed for and maybe twisted their arms into. But they had made enough money and had enough success in this sort of gapping that they wanted to own something outright. They wanted to produce something that they developed from the ground up. And, you know, I had my friend Aaron that I was shooting short films with that, you know, made him my head of production. Well, he had been working at that time at Polygram, and he had been in London for, something close to a year. I believe he was working on Notting Hill, was the film that he was working on. But while he was over there, he ended up meeting this film student and his fiance, which was, you know, Chris Nolan and Emma Thomas, Chris's wife. And Emma's just fantastic, by the way. She's a wonderful producer, and I always have to. I always am ashamed when I ever say anything about, you know, Emma, Chris's wife, because she's a phenomenal producer in her own right, and would have been even if she wasn't with Chris. They moved over to Los Angeles, and Chris was still finishing up his thesis film, which was Following. And Chris showed me Following, and I just, you know, it wasn't quite finished. I immediately wanted us to put some money into finishing it and buying it. And the principals of the company, Will and Chris, Will Tyrer and Chris Ball, were skeptical. I mean, it was a little black and white student film. But they said, you know, he's talented. What else, you know, would he like to do? Would he like, you know, let's maybe, you know, does he have another pitch in him? And the pitch that Chris had was Memento. It was the initial pitch was a rough take on a story that his brother Jonah had written, but with this, you know, very interesting structural device, this horseshoe-shaped structure. And he pitched it to me in a pub. He actually drew the horseshoe shape of the structure on a beer mat. It was one of these like, well, you know, the story's kind of complicated to explain right now, but it's going to look like this, you know, it's going to be a U.
Yeah.
And in my naivete, I was just like, you know, fuck yeah, all right, let's do that. And sorry, but that was the it was exciting. Chris was just an exciting guy to talk to. It's very easy to work with a genius if you don't try to get in their way. You know, my philosophy of development has always been to leave no fingerprints, to leave no trace. You know, I'm here to make the creator's voice stand out, not my own voice. And so just facilitating what Chris and Jonah were doing was a very easy thing. They had a very clear vision. There were major changes to the story all the way up through the shooting, you know, the sort of negotiating our way to an ending that was truly satisfying, or beginning in this case, that was truly satisfying. But the film was, you know, was fully funded by Will and Chris with no issues. I don't know that they even watched any of the dailies as we were shooting. I think they came to set.
All right.
That it was very, very simple. It was $4.5 million, and which was low budget at the time. Back then, there was a thing called a video safe number. Video. That was I don't know any of you kids listening. We used to have hard media back then called DVDs and cassettes. And and we would sell these things and they would have movies on them.
Yeah, exactly.
And you could usually project that a movie would have a number that, like, with a thriller, $4.5 to $5 million was video safe, meaning that if you had the right stars in a thriller, even if it didn't do any money in the theater, you could get that amount of money back out of video. So we knew that we could get about $4.5 to $5 million out of video domestically. Sure, why not? Let's take a flyer at it and see. The idea was we're going to produce it and sell it. We produced the movie, and that was no issue at all. They completely gave us free creative rein. And I think the reason why the film is as particular as it is that nobody looked over our shoulders at all. Not even once.
Right.
Good. Yeah. And I mean, I think that Will and Chris might have seen it at the premiere. And unfortunately, that premiere was a distribution screening, and everyone hated it. We made the film, wanted to sell it, and everybody hated it. At least that's the way I remember it. I had a Harvey Weinstein moment, the only Harvey Weinstein moment that I ever had in Hollywood. We were standing in the lobby of the, actually we were in like the aisle of the theater to leave. Everyone sort of shuffling out quietly, not wanting to look me in the eye. And, I mean, fucking hated it. Harvey Weinstein kind of, you know, blusters his way up the aisle, and he's got me and Aaron, my producing partner, and Chris Ball, one of the investors, sort of pinned against the wall. And he says, you know, that wasn't even a movie. That was 2 hours of my life I won't get back. Ooh. And
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And now, not to excuse any of his monstrousness, but to his credit, Harvey did later write a letter, a one-line letter that said, "Every day I tell everyone I'm the idiot who passed on Memento." And signed Harvey, and we had that hanging in the kitchen of our office for years.
Wow.
but yeah, nobody wanted the movie. And so to Will and Chris's credit, they put the money together to self-release. We hired Bob Burney, who had just recently distributed the movie Happiness. We figured if he could, if he could distribute Happiness, he could certainly distribute Memento. And you know, and the rest is kind of history. It was never on more than 125 screens at a time, but you know, back then you could hold theaters for several months, and we made a nice little dent and got some nominations, and then Chris got to be Chris.
Yeah, I mean, I've constantly have these conversations, Becky and I have these conversations, John, and with other people, where no one wants to take a chance. And credit where credit's due, the guys you work with, the investors you work with, they actually, you know, put the money where their mouth was.
Oh, yeah.
And actually just got on with it. Yeah. And I thought, that's brave to do that. I mean, back in that time, I mean, $4.5 million is probably, what, $10 million today? Maybe a bit more, I don't know.
Yeah, probably. Well, I mean, to give you a sense of how things have changed, the video safe number I was saying before was, you know, around $5 million back in 1998, 1999, about $5 million dollars. And that same number, what a streamer, if a streamer like Netflix was, you know, or Amazon was going to say, you know, what their safe number is, it's 350,000.
Wow.
Right.
That's the safe number. So obviously people are just incredibly risk averse now. And there's also, there's a lot fewer, lot fewer profit centers. You can get to, you can get to the audience, but not very profitably. Graham Taylor, who's the head of William Morris Endeavor's independent financing division, he had this great quote a number of years ago. He said, he said that, you know, there used to be oceans of dollars, and now there are rivers of nickels. And you know, it's the same amount of money that's out there, but what it requires to collect that money, it's there's a lot more work that goes into it. So you can't go and spend $5 million on a low budget movie. You know, that's the other thing to remember is, you know, at the time that we made Memento, you know, Joey Pants and Carrie-Anne Moss and Guy Pearce were not huge stars or anything.
No, and it's just, again, it's just really interesting to speak with you about this, John, because everything always seems to come around, and all the difficulties everybody has. And it, again, it always comes down to one thing, and it's called money.
It
doesn't seem to go away, does it?
No, it's, I think that's always a challenge, isn't it? And there's so many great projects out there, isn't it? And they just don't get to see the light of day, which is a shame. You know, it is hard.
Now, I'm very hopeful. I do have to say, I am very hopeful. When I first moved out to Los Angeles and I kind of really got the idea of how film worked, and this was, you know, 97, 98, it was right when I was starting to work with New Market Films, and, you know, we were about to start this whole journey into Memento. And I started to realize how difficult it actually is. I don't think I quite realized at the time how lucky I was to be working for a bank where I had a one-stop shop for my money. They didn't do everything I wanted to do by any stretch, but, you know, I didn't have to go far and wide. But something that is has really struck me is that back then I was, when I realized the difficulties of getting into the business, I said, you know, this would be a lot easier if it was 1908. You know, I'd be jumping right into the business. But in a way, I really do. Had I been 90 years earlier, I'd have been fine. But I probably could have done the vaudeville stuff there too. But but I actually think that right now, 25 years after I came into this business, I think that right now we're far closer to that sort of flat playing field. The fact that, I mean, you can shoot really fantastic footage on prosumer technology, even on your phone. I've seen some beautiful footage, you know, shot just on iPhones with changeable lens packages, and or even without. You can edit at home. You can distribute, you know, self-distribute through Amazon, through YouTube. The ability to get out, to the ability to make really quality stuff that competes with anyone else in the world. Is you can do that now, and in a way that in the history of a film you've never been able to do. But even though you can make it cheaply, you can make a gorgeous looking film for $300,000. You could make a film that looks like it's $5 million for $300,000 now. But how you then get that film out into the world and get anyone to see it becomes difficult. A $300,000 film is probably not going to have a star that's going to draw attention to it. You're going to go onto Amazon. You're going to be put into that, you know, archive, into their vault or whatever. And if you're not right there on the landing page that people land on when they go to Amazon, they might not know that your film even exists. So, so you end up all that money that you saved in the making the film, you now have to spend in marketing the film.
Yeah.
And getting the outreach. But, you know, again, I'm hopeful because those tools are there too.
Yeah, absolutely. And just going back to obviously with what you did, obviously with Memento, and that led on to, you know, a run of classic movies with Donnie Darko starring Jake Gyllenhaal. You did Monster with Charlize Theron, Prestige with Christian Bale, Scarlett Johansson, Michael Caine. You know, the list goes on and on, just to, you know, just to name a few. But John, what would you say has been your standout moment in your career, would you say?
Oh,
that's a question.
That's a really, that is a tough one. Because, you know,
it is a tough one.
Now, I like that because I kind of feel, you know, my career, I kind of feel like has been broken into a few different pieces as an executive. And during that period of time, I feel very proud of several of the films that I worked on. I feel a particular amount of pride about The Prestige, the Nolan film, because that was, it would seem like Memento would have been the harder one to get done. But it wasn't. I mean, this was a massive jump up in budget from what we had ever done before at Newmarket. We had to bring on a partner. You know, we'd brought on a studio partner to distribute with us. We couldn't do it on our own. We also kind of got into this, wasn't a battle because we capitulated immediately, but into sort of this back and forth with Warner Brothers over who is going to get to, you know, work with Chris first. Were they going to get to do The Dark Knight, or were we going to get to do The Prestige? And and it really looked for a long time like that just that film wasn't going to happen. And I loved the Christopher Priest novel, and Chris did, and it just, I thought his take on it was brilliant. And the fact that movie exists makes me very proud.
Yeah, it is a great film. I love The Prestige. It's brilliant film.
Yeah, I do. And yeah. Big fan of Hugh Jackman as well. You know, just, and I think with Michael Caine as well, John, you can't really argue. I mean, because it's funny how things like stand the test of time, and you go back and you think, oh, well, that was actually really cool. And I think talking to you now and some of the conversations Becky and I have had, it's always nice to talk to the people that have actually done it, been there and done it. And you think you go and turn the movie on and you say to your buddy, I've just spoken to the guy that did that. And that's what we like about the podcast, because you have cool conversations and it's just nice to have those chats, and you understand a bit of the history that's behind it. And where you highlighted where the national newspaper didn't quite report what happened in Memento, we see that daily. Just fake news is just constant. It's like, okay, what rubbish will we being told today?
I don't know what to believe.
Well, and about this,
what shit's coming out.
And about entertainment, and about you know, popular culture, it seems like there's I don't know if people assume that it's just because it's popular culture, it's entertainment or whatever, it's not important, and so you can spin whatever, you know, yarn you want. I'm not sure. I think for a long time, you know, obviously the Hollywood studio system for a long time made it their business to, you know, invent the legend of Hollywood and, you know, to sort of spin all these, you know, stories of Hollywood magic. A lot of those stories I still have to work against. But I feel like conversations like you're having here, and where, you know, I even enjoy just talking to other people in the business who are, you know, working, and what are you working on? How are you getting it done? Because I think it's great, your show, you know, being broadcast out for anyone to be able to listen to, because something that I do a lot of seminars. I do a lot of, I speak at schools, I speak at, you know, film schools, and there are a lot of writer training courses that I've been involved in, seminars. And one of the things I try to impress, and I think that this podcast, I think, does a good job of as well, is that there isn't magic to this. This is an art form. And the magic of making a movie is in the fact that these artists and craftspeople are very talented. But it's not by accident. You know, it's these are crafts that people are very proud of, and they practice and they perfect. And every film that, you know, comes out the gate and is actually, you know, good, bad, or indifferent, it is a work that a lot of people crafted. And I find getting to hear about how things came together and all these, you know, the even the minutiae of the details, I found that far more interesting than, you know, the idea that someone was discovered while, you know, sitting on a stool at a soda fountain and, you know, came and made them a big star, you know. I'm sure those things happen, exactly. But that's just not very interesting to me.
And I mean, with all the projects you've been involved with, like Becky just mentioned, you know, if I just pick out the Mexican genres like Brad and Julia Roberts, did you, to understand a bit more about your process, would you actually have the whole budget, and would you go and deal with the agent? Would you deal with the whole process for the movie and actually, you know, engage and contract Brad or Julia to that particular movie, or Michael Caine? Would you do everything?
We were a very small shop. Newmarket was at the largest we were ever. You know, I think there was, 10 of us. And that included, you know, Bob Burney and, you know, three or four support people in New York. So in LA, there was six of us, two being the principals of the company, who were interested in funding the films, but they weren't otherwise involved in much of the day-to-day. There was, you know, Aaron Ryder, who was our producer, Robert Fivelant, who was a producer in his own right now and has a wonderful documentary out that just won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance called Summer of Soul.
Oh, wow.
It's a fantastic documentary.
Oh, cool.
He was our business affairs at the time. A very smart guy, you know, and then, you know, and myself. And then we had, you know, our production, legal, and accounts payable, receivable, that kind of stuff. But like really the people who were working on the films, it was Aaron and Robert and I. And when you've got three people working that way, you end up wearing a lot of hats. I was the kind of, you know, in one of the last films that I did in the Newmarket era was a film called Hesher that we did a limited run of. It was a Joseph Gordon-Levitt film. We did a limited run in 10 cities here in the U.S. And every city that I could get to, I went and like sound checked the theaters. You know, it was a film with this incredible Metallica soundtrack. The only movie ever to get, it's the only film that Metallica has ever granted music to. And I was like, I'm not going to have a theater not rock this out.
Cool.
It's like, this has got to be loud. This has got to, like, you know, and I actually told the managers of the theaters, like, if somebody doesn't complain about this, you're not playing it loud enough. But, you know, because there are scenes in the beginning that's like, you have to, the audience has got to want it to turn down. and it does almost immediately. But, you know, if you don't, it was one of those things that had to come out with a shock, you know, at the opening. I take it very seriously. I take every angle of it seriously, and I try to be involved in every angle that I can. That's why I loved independent film. It was the one part of the prestige that disappointed me, was that working on any large film, and to an extent the Mexican was the same, on any film that is of that scale, you only get to do a certain amount of work on it, then you sort of pass it down the chain. There's so many people involved. Mm-hmm. So like with the Prestige, I was very, very involved in the production or in the development. We went through the production phase and the casting, and you know, I was working with Aaron, Chris, and John Papsidera, who was the casting director. I'm in the Prestige in a blink and you'll miss it role, because
I'll have to watch that tonight. That's on my list to watch. Message you later.
In the scene where Christian Bale does the bullet catch and it goes wrong, no spoilers for anybody who hasn't seen it.
Okay, yeah.
I'm the asshole in the crowd who yells at him to do the bullet catch. I'm the one who taunts him into doing it. I'm the one who says, do the bullet catch. You know, that's me. You know, that was what, so yeah, it was, we worked really closely, you know, on that one. But after a point, after production, you know, it was kind of handed off to our distribution partners, and there wasn't a whole lot more I could do. The Mexican was kind of the same way. I was very involved in the development, but, the casting on that one was a bit of a horror story. The whole Julia Roberts and Brad Pitt thing, I use that as a cautionary tale now, because the Mexican was supposed to be, when it was first developed, it was intended to be a feature about like $6 to $8 million. Still, you know, Gore Verbinski directing. And and it was going to be Johnny Depp and Marissa Tomei.
Okay.
And really funny that Gore ended up working with Johnny Depp down the road on the Pirates films. But at the time, at the time, Johnny wasn't a star anymore. He was in sort of dip in his career. You know, he was after like the, you know, Nick of Time, Seventh Gate era, where things weren't working out so well for him. And it was before Pirates kicked him back into gear. And we were told in no uncertain terms by various other financiers and distribution that we were talking to about partnering on it, that Johnny Depp was just not a movie star, and we needed to replace him. And fortunately, we had a favor owed to us by Brad Pitt. Brad was supposed to have starred in Memento.
Oh, okay. Right. Oh, wow.
Okay.
Brad was the original. He was the original Leonard Shelby in Memento. He dropped out of Memento. Not exactly last minute, but he dropped out to go do the movie Almost Famous, which he also dropped out of to go to the movie The Fountain, which he also dropped out of. I don't know if he, I don't know what he dropped out of that to do, but he did not do Memento, and and sort of kind of came back around on The Mexican, and was happy to actually kind of, you know, drop in to the Depp role, and it was still gonna be roughly around the same budget, you know, still around $6 to $8 million, with some back end to Brad, I'm sure. But as soon as we had Brad Pitt, we were being told, well, you can't have Brad Pitt and Marissa Tomei. That's not a matchup. That's no good at all. He's a huge star. You've got to have somebody that's also a huge star. And so you've got to get Julia Roberts. And so, okay, so Julia Roberts. Well, Julia Roberts doesn't owe us a favor. Julia Roberts isn't going to take it in the teeth. So she's like, yeah, I'm going to do this movie. I'm going to get my full pay. And so as soon as she was getting her full pay, then Brad Pitt's team's like, well, why are we doing you any favors? If Julia's getting her full pay, we want our full pay. So a movie that should have been this, like, this fun little under the radar $8 million Johnny Depp, like, fun little farce, ended up being a $40 million spectacle And not only could it not make its money back, you know, theatrically, because it just shouldn't have been that. I mean, if you watch that movie, it's clearly, it's the story. The story is an independent film story, you know? Once it got that big, two terrible things then happened. Not only was it too big to succeed on its own merits, but there was this wonderful, wonderful subplot involving James Gandolfini. James Gandolfini is this hitman who, you know, he discovers that he's homosexual, or rather embraces the fact that he's homosexual and something he's been hiding. And it was this really wonderful subplot with him and this man that he falls in love with, that now it's a $40 million film and this is going to be a wide release. And that ended up getting edited and carved back in a way that it would not have been had we controlled the film, had it still been a, you know, an $8 million film that Newmarket controlled. I found that disappointing. I know a lot of the excuse was that you're just making the cut shorter and tighter because you get more screenings in a day and therefore more tickets. But I really did not like the edit there. I also, we got completely screwed by audience expectations, because the poster was Julia Roberts and Brad Pitt holding hands and looking at each other, you know, looking at lovingly in each other's eyes. And the movie is not a love story. Julia Roberts' character is this horrible, just harridan of a character that the entire time you're thinking, well, these people shouldn't be together, you know? And the fun of it, you know, that like they're not a good couple. And when you think of it as being, it's like Johnny Depp and Marissa Tomei, there's a comedic repartee that's there. He's the ne'er-do-well guy who just can't get his shit straight, and his girlfriend is like, come on already. And you know, you can kind of see how Marissa Tomei can do that. She can be the completely frustrated girlfriend, but also be lovable and empathetic while doing it. And and Johnny Depp could be, you know, the lovable fuck up. And and unfortunately, Brad came off as kind of a lovable fuck up, but Julia just came off as like really kind of a creep. I mean, really, really an a-hole in that movie. And and the balance was weird. And so all of the she did not play it as a comedic villain. She was just a villain. And then Brad just seemed browbeaten and like henpecked and weird. So we got these reviews. The first reviews that came out were about, you know, like, well, this is just the worst romantic comedy ever. And I was thinking, I agree. It's not a romantic comedy. You're absolutely right. It's also a terrible ghost story because there are no ghosts in it. You know, it really was reamed for not being something that it never intended to be.
Isn't it again, John, that's why it's always fascinating to talk to the people in the know, because to the outside consumer, they always see everything's all fluffy in the world of entertainment and everything's all great and the cotton walls around them and it's all really cool. But when you actually get to the nitty-gritty, it's the agent or the management at the time turned around and said, well, if you're getting that amount of money, then I want to get this amount of money. And if you were doing that, then I've got bigger balls than you. And that's what's going to happen. It's like, come on, man. Yeah. You know, your favor turned into a real commercial check, really, at the end of the day, didn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, the number of times that I know over the years that we wanted to offer a role to an actor and we were told that they were not available or that they passed, and then later found out that the project had never been introduced to them. It happens. I think one of the, probably the, and I know I'm opening up a whole whole world of trouble for myself here, but really the thing that has been the great hamperer of film, of progress in film, and just of anything getting done, happens to be the agencies, and particularly packaging. The idea that the agency is going to take a packaging fee, that, you know, you want to work with our actors? Okay, well, if you want this male lead from our agency, we won't give them to unless you also take our female lead. And now you're using two of our actors and we're processing that. So now you need to pay us a fee for having processed that for you, this packaging, something on top of the percentage they're already taking from the talent. And in doing that, it ends up, you know, it's the reason why you would think that there's 25 actors in Hollywood, the same people keep getting the same work. I think it's incredibly detrimental to the quality of work when you don't have a new talent that's allowed to get anything done. You know, if you can't break through with the agency, you know, that I find that really disheartening.
I think, no, I don't think you're wrong, John, because it's my bugbear as well. It's no different to in the music industry, really, where, you know, to be honest with you, the agents are only really interested in getting the live shows and making as much money as they possibly can. Although COVID's going to put a hold on that at the moment, because as much as I want to see live music and Becky does, you know, we got festival promoters over here that want to put 50,000 people in a field. It's just not going to happen. So I don't think you're off ball with any of that, really. I do think it is a problem. And I think managers get fed up with agents. Publicists don't really talk to anybody either. The agent doesn't only talk unless it's got zeros after it. And you just think, and I've had many arguments. So you're on my wavelength completely. And I won't take any of that crap whatsoever, because they just, unless it's all packaged up with $10 million around it, they're not really interested. And it's just like, hang on a minute. And you're right, half the projects never get to the artist to see. They're always, you know, dealt with internally. So, oh, no, they weren't in. So that's partly why we started the podcast, is actually sort of ruffle a few feathers as well.
Well, I think if some of the talent realized what was happening, you know, just... the last time this happened to me was about 2 years ago. There was a project that I was trying to put together. I was brought in as a producer, and there was already a director attached, a very talented and, you know, bankable director. We were waiting on a piece of talent that was busy, that wanted to do the film, and just, he was busy. But the director, he ran into an actor at a party. Another very talented, very famous actor ran into him at a party and was like, look, I'm tired of waiting on this other guy. Do you want to take this role? And this new famous actor said, sure. And there was sort of this handshake agreement. And, you know, the actor and the director are calling me up, calling up the rest of the team. Hey, this is something we're going to be doing. This is awesome. Okay, we just have to, you know, clear it with his agent. Okay. And it goes through the whole agency rigmarole. And when it came out the other side, the budget had gone up by, you know, more than eight times the original budget. Because, you know, while the actor was saying, look, I really want to work with this director. This is a, you know, an older, very talented, very, you know, almost, you know, legendary director that I want to work with. And I will take less in order to have this experience. I'll take a lower fee in order to have this experience. This would be meaningful to me. And his agency killed that project. The film never got made and probably never will.
Yeah. Well, shame.
It is, really. It is always very sad. And I think, there's either deal makers or deal breakers, John. So I get lost for words sometimes. Yeah, things like that.
It just takes you back, doesn't it?
Just gets really annoying, and you think, "Hang on a minute, do people ever get to see stuff?" And we're not curing cancer, you know.
At the beginning of the conversation, I said, "You know, people would ask how, how did this? It's not a terrible movie. How did it get made?" And it's like, ask how the good ones get made, because
know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's always and one of my sayings as well, John, I don't know if you heard this one before, but I just like this one. People get promoted to a level of incompetence.
Yeah, I would agree.
It's your favorite.
But also, you know, Becky can tell you more, but you know, she had a big career in theatre. So she started off in theatre and, you know, she's toured all over the world and done all sorts of bits and pieces with King of Dubai and Andrew Lloyd Webber. And even she struggled with certain points, you know, what you was doing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like what we touched on, wasn't it, at the beginning of the conversation, just, you know, I trained, you know, in theatre and performing arts. But until you sort of, you know, it's that conversation of until you're out in the big bad world, I don't think you can, and you can't be taught that. I think you've got to go through the ups and downs of this business because it's not all glitz and glam, is it? And I think that's what people see, you know, the outsiders, people looking in. But it's actually being out there and doing it. And it is a challenge, but, you know, we wouldn't be in it, would we? We're all in entertainment. We're still in it, doing it.
We're still doing it. And, you know,
exactly.
When I talk to people who are wanting to get into the business, there's actually, it always reminds me of the Prestige that, you know, are you watching closely, which is the opening line of the Prestige. The question I always ask when people are like, you know, how do you break into the business? I want to do this. I want to break into the business. My question is always, do you want to feel the magic or do you want to know the trick? You cannot have both. Yeah. Once you know how the trick is performed, you will never feel that same magic about that trick again. You know, if you've ever learned a really, you know, clever, you know, magic trick, sleight of hand or something, every time you do it, you're kind of going, I can't believe this person fell for it, because I can see so easily how I'm, you know, hiding this coin. Yeah. How are they missing it? And that's the way, you know, you can either watch film and completely, you know, you're caught up in the magic of it all the time and you just love movies. If you love movies that way, maybe you don't want to make them. Maybe you just want to watch them, enjoy them, enjoy the magic. Or perhaps you would like to be a reviewer or a critic or someone who can get involved in the academic side, or to teach it, or to be involved in a way where you can celebrate it. But if you actually want to craft it, that involves knowing the trick. Yeah. And a lot of that magic goes away. I find it remarkable and very special. One of the reasons why I miss film festivals is because I'm very excited when something is so good that I feel the magic again. There's actually a moment in The Prestige when Hugh Jackman has built his Tesla device. Spoilers, I guess, but it's an old movie. Hugh Jackman's built a Tesla device and they bring in this theatrical entrepreneur, this impresario that they're going to rent a theater from. And he watches the trick and this awe kind of comes over his face and he says, it's been so long since I saw real magic. And I feel like him. anytime I see a good movie, something that really stirs me, that even though I know the trick, they made me feel the magic again. And that's what keeps me coming back.
Well, I think again, that's a really good point as well, John, because it would probably, if I changed that around and said to you, it's a bit like when you're 7 years old or 6 years old and you come downstairs on Christmas Day and you see all those presents in front of you. And then when you get a bit older, someone says to you, Santa Claus doesn't exist. And you're like, oh, bloody hell, does he not?
but he's like, oh, that was so good. I enjoyed that magic. Why are you telling me this? Why are you telling me? And I kind of feel bad when we get into, you know, some of these stories, some of the, like, the behind the scenes stories, because I'm not trying to, you know, kick dirt on anybody's, you know, magical view of the world. But, you know, all these things, they took work. They didn't just happen. And a lot of times the work's kind of funny and a lot of times the work is kind of awful. You come out with, hopefully, with work at the end that other people look at it and think, oh, it couldn't have been any other way. That's just perfect the way it is.
Wow. That's all for part one with our chat with John Cry. And we look forward to catching up with John next week in part two of this really interesting and in-depth conversation about Hollywood. And we look forward to discussing more and more about the film industry and John's latest project next week. And now it's that time again this week. It's over to Bex for the question of the day.
Let's get started with this week's question. The very first BAFTA award for best film was given in which year? If you think you know the answer, then please get in touch with us. You can do this by sending in your answer via voice message right from your phone for free. And this can be done via www.anchor.fm/entertainmentengine by clicking on the message button, or you can email us your answer to podcast@seamlessentertainment.co.uk for a chance to be featured on our show.
Well, that's all for today's episode of The Entertainment Engine. And thanks for listening.
Join us again next week for part two of our conversation with John Cry.
Plus, we will have our question of the day and music and movie facts for our listeners.
It would be great to have your feedback on the show, so you can always drop us a message at any time. We would love to hear from you.
So make sure you subscribe to the podcast on your favourite podcast platforms so you never miss an episode.
Thanks for listening to the show, and remember to all stay safe.
The Entertainment Engine.